going to begin this evening by doing the recollection of the Buddha. So, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. This evening, I've chosen to give a talk on a very profound and very deep discourse that the Buddha gave. And I find this a very challenging discourse. And this evening, maybe some of the things that I may say you may find challenging, so please listen with an inquiring mind, an open mind. And the reason I've chosen this particular discourse is that it does begin with a set of 10 questions. And these particular questions are profound philosophical questions that we often ask in life. And they're also very profound religious questions. A part of the religious search is seeking answers to questions. The question about existence, the question about life, where we've come from, where we're going, what's the purpose, who am I? These sort of questions. Excuse me. And this particular discourse is from the numerical discourses. It's the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's in the group of tens. So there's 10 questions. And the 10 questions, I'll read the discourse first. It's a very short and brief one. And then I give a commentary on that. And this begins, it's called The Roots of Everything. And the Buddha's talking to the monks, and he says, "It may be, O monks, that wandering ascetics or wandering teachers or religious teachers of other traditions and persuasions might ask you, 'What are all things? In what are all things rooted? How do they come to actual existence? Where do they arise? Where do they converge? What is the foremost of all things? What is their master? What is the highest of all things? What is the essence of all things? Where do all things merge? And where do they end?'" I will maybe go through some of these questions first before giving the response, the reply, because the first question, in what are all things rooted? I mean, where do things come from? firstly, when in the Buddha is talking about all things, what do we mean by all things? And in Buddhism, it has a very specific meaning. It's basically all experience, everything that we can know, everything that is comprehended, everything that we can understand. So what is this all? What can we understand? What is the means of experiencing the world? And the Buddha actually defined the means of experiencing the world as this body and mind. These are the ways, the mechanisms, the doorways for perceiving and realizing and understanding and having contact with the world, isn't it? This body and mind, having the five sense doors of the body, the sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and then the conceptual ability of the mind to understand and be conscious and aware of these things. So it is the body and mind that has contact with the world. So in Buddhism we call this the five aggregates of being, because the Buddha defined existence up into five things. That is the physical body, then the ability to experience feeling, both physical feeling of both pleasure, neutral feeling, and pain, and also emotional, mental feeling, feelings of happiness or even equanimity, and then sadness and sorrow. Those are feelings that we experience and know the world by. So that's one way of knowing the world, knowing everything, knowing all our experience. We judge the world and existence and life through our physical body and health and our physical feelings and psychological feelings and emotions. The other way of knowing the world is through the doors of perception, the way we perceive and memorize and know this is a color blue. We've been taught and conditioned to conceptualize the world. This is a sound of a certain voice or an animal or a bird. We perceive the world through the doors of perception and memorize those perceptions through our language. And in this way, we can conceptualize about the world. So that leads to the other door of perception, thinking. The ability to, once having felt and perceived, to think about and conceptualize, to intellectualize and rationalize. This is the other realm of the mind, to know. We know the world by analysis, by thinking and understanding. And then the other way to know the world is through just conscious awareness, to know. When something arises through the eye, we know that this is light, this is color. We can know feeling, we can know a thought, we can know a mood, we can know an idea. We can know all the other aspects of our sense door experience. And so it's through the body and these five aspects of the mind that we know everything in the world. And that's actually interesting, because the Buddha was not interested in about intellectual ideas of everything that cannot be known. There are some religious traditions or other ascetic traditions or philosophical traditions that may speak of the unknowable, the incomprehensible, the mystical. The Buddha was not really interested in something that cannot be known. If it cannot be known, is it of benefit? If it is so mystical that it is a mystery and cannot be understood by human consciousness, human intelligence, human wisdom, human experience, then is it of benefit to humanity? That was the question he asked. And he was very pragmatic. He was saying that he's only interested in those things that can be comprehended by a human being through their knowledge, through their intellect, through their wisdom, through their experience. If it cannot be known, it's beyond your comprehension, then it's out of the realms of possibilities to know, and therefore is of little use to the problematic nature of human existence. It's like going, if you're sick and you go to a doctor and he says, yes, you can get better from that illness. And you say, oh, how? He says, well, there is a medicine. And you say, well, what's that medicine? And you say, it's a mystery. It's unknowable. It's unattainable. It's incomprehensible, that medicine. Then is it of benefit to that ill person? The Buddha was very pragmatic in this approach to the philosophical ideas of the world. He's not saying that you cannot intellectualize in that way. He's saying that what he's concerned with is what can be known and experienced by the human mind, what can be experienced here and now. So this is what we're talking about, the all. So in what are all things rooted? That is, where do they all come from? That was the first question that we often, he asked, and we often ask, isn't it? Where do I come from? Where have I been created from? That's a profound question. Then he goes on to talk about, if you're asked, how do things come into actual existence? Is it a creator God? Is it from some divine essence? Is it just pure energy? Is it just chemicals? Is it the grand primordial cosmic liquid that reaches a certain temperature and human beings suddenly appear in the forms of cells and evolve, and then humanity comes into existence? How do things come into existence? Where do they arise? Where do they converge? Where do things go to? Where do things, what is their point of meeting, a point of unity? What is the foremost of all things? What's the highest? What's the most important thing in existence? What is their master? Is their master some deva or some divine being outside of yourself? Is that the Lord? Is that the divine? Is that the highest? Is that the controller? What is the highest of all things? What's the supreme of all existence? And what is the essence? What's the underlying substance to all things? What's the most important, unique, single quality of all things? And where do all things merge? And where do they end? Where do things go to? Where does life go to? Where does existence end? So these are very significant questions, and no doubt you've asked yourself these very questions. And it's very interesting. I'll give you the response and then go on to speak about this. The Buddha's response was, if monks, you are asked by members of other religious traditions or wandering ascetics of other persuasions these 10 questions, monks, you should reply as follows. This is the Buddha's response to these 10 questions. All things are rooted in desire. They come to actual existence through attention of the mind. They originate from contact. They converge on feelings. The foremost of all things is concentration. All things are mastered by mindfulness. Their peak is wisdom. The essence of all things is liberation. All things merge in the deathless, and Nibbana, enlightenment, is their culmination. So that is the response that the Buddha recommended that to the monks, that if you're ever asked any of these 10 questions, what's the essence of all things? The essence is liberation. Where do all things merge? The deathless. And this response is actually very interesting, because nowhere does the Buddha talk about something outside yourself, outside what you can experience. He's not saying that the master of all things is some divine being or some creator, or the answer to these questions are in some religious book. You notice that all these things can be psychologically known. They can be known in your own mind, through your own experience, through your own wisdom, through your own understanding. So that's actually one significant event, that the Buddha's one unique aspect of the Buddha's path is to turn inward, not to go outward. Often you find that philosophical traditions or religious traditions will tend to externalize understanding, tend to externalize experience, try to seek answers outside of oneself. And so we find that science tends to do that. A spiritual path which is seeking truth, seeking an understanding of all things, needs to turn in to one's own experience and turn into the mind, turn in on itself. And here the Buddha is giving an answer, which is to turn into your mind to know these things. So his response to "in what are all things rooted?" His response that all things, all reality, all experience is rooted in desire. By this he's saying that firstly you have come, you have grown out from your past desire. That is what has brought about this existence and will create future existence. So this life has come from the desire to be, the desire to exist, the desire to experience, the desire to create. You have not come from a creator God, but rather from your own creation, the creation that is motivated by desire. And we see the power of desire when that creation is threatened, don't we? When we're sick, when we're ill, when we're going to die, we see the desire for existence, the desire for ongoing. That strength of desire is what perpetuates life. And as meditators, we start to be aware of desire, start to notice, start to investigate, start to see how desire is the source of both your happiness and suffering. It's through wanting something or wanting to get rid of something, not allowing the world to change. The very nature of existence is to be in a constant state of change and flux, but it's the mind which desires it to be otherwise. When we're comfortable and happy, we don't want it to change. When we're unhappy and depressed, we desperately want it to change. It's that wanting, that desire for sensual experience, and when I say sensual, I mean wanting to see pleasant objects and avoid seeing unpleasant objects, wanting to hear pleasant sounds and things that you agree with or like, and avoid unpleasant sound, wanting to taste just delicious things and not taste things that you dislike, wanting to taste, wanting to touch comfortable and pleasant sensations or tactile objects, not to experience discomfort, and wanting to smell pleasant odors and avoid unpleasant odors. But can we do that? Life experience is to experience this whole myriad of sense contact, and it is the desire which forces us to seek only what we like and avoid what we dislike. And this desire has an energy Have you noticed when you want something desperately, how much effort you put into obtaining that desire, that goal? And then when you've got it, is it really satisfying? Does it last? Or does the desire drive you to seek and search for something else? So desire is what is the source of becoming, the source of existence, the source of going on. So that is the root of all things. How do they come to actual existence? How does everything arise in the world? The Buddha is saying that everything is created in the world through the attention of mind. Now that's probably not what you're expecting as an answer. Some people may say that things are created in the world by some divine being, a deity, through some primordial essence or some material existence, process of chemical reactions. Here the Buddha is saying that things arise in the world, everything arises in the world because you give attention to it. It is the conscious focusing of the mind on something that allows you to know it. If you don't give attention to something, then you won't know it. This comes into the area of conscious experience. For us to see, for example, we have to be able to have a functioning eye organ. And then if we open our eyes and come into contact with that object visually, then, for example, if I ask everyone to look at this microphone, then it's only when your eye comes into contact with the microphone you actually see the microphone. If you've got your eyes shut, even though you've got an operating eye organ, you only have an intellectual idea of the microphone from memory. It's only when you open your eye, look in this direction, and focus on the microphone, that for you, at that point in time, this microphone comes into existence here and now. So this is where the Buddha is saying that all things come into existence through focusing attention on them at that point in that time. Otherwise, if we're not looking at the microphone, and I say the word microphone, we can conceptualize or visualize a microphone in our mind, but that experience is mental consciousness. It is not visual consciousness. So yes, we're experiencing mentally the idea of a microphone, but it is not the reality of this particular object, this particular microphone. The one we may conceptualize about may be smaller, larger, different color. Here, this microphone, when we look at it, we see, and the reality of this object comes into our existence. So existence is what we pay attention to. So that's why it's very important to be very careful of what you give attention to. If you give attention to the people you hate, then what does that lead to? Who do you become? What is your world? It becomes everything, doesn't it? Hatred becomes all-consuming. If we give attention to loving-kindness, then that becomes our reality. So what we pay attention to is very important. That creates our world. Each individual is in their own mental, psychological world. That is why you can have two people who are very close. They can be twins or partners. They live their life together, and one experience can arise that they both experience, but their way of handling that experience can be vastly different. And you may have seen that in your own lives. Someone who is, say, has a death in the family. One person may be able to deal with that and let go of it, move on, whereas the other person dwells on that death, suffers, cannot let go, will not let go, refuses to let go. And so they get depressed and sad. Even though those two people have had the same experience, they live in their own world experience of that event because of how they look at it. So be very careful of what you give attention to and also how you give attention to things. All things originate from contact. So where does everything arise? It arises through, as I explained, when the eye comes into contact with an object, then that thing originates right there. We can only know this present moment. That is why everyone here in this room has arisen, been born, here and now. We can use that term to say we have been born in this instant moment. In my experience of the world here and now, you are all arising in my world experience here and now. And I welcome you into my world experience, and for myself, I am arising in your world experience here and now. Then, when we separate, you go home, I have ceased to exist in your visual experience. I may be in your mental experience as a memory, but at that moment, visually, I have ceased to exist. Something else has arisen in your visual consciousness. Your visual perception, something new, a new experience. And so we start to see this process of arising and passing away, of our constant conscious experience. It is never stable. Where do all things converge? They converge, the Buddha said, on feeling. For example, when we have an experience, we pay our attention to something, like this microphone. It's a very neutral thing, so that's why I'm using it as an example. This microphone, we have then contact, then a feeling may arise associated with this microphone. I may bump into it, then there's a physical feeling of pain, or if I don't, there may be just a mental feeling. Now that mental feeling will depend on my likes and dislikes, won't it? If I like, I'm a techno freak who loves hi-fi equipment, and I've really got incredible interest in microphones, which I don't at all, but you know, I might think, well, this is, you know, this particular brand, and that's superb quality, or it's really, really the best, and I really like the sound or the shape or the form of this. So it arises a feeling in me of desire, of like, of appreciation. Now, if I really know my stuff, I might think, well, this is a cheapo mic, this is really lousy, because if I turn my head like this, and the sound doesn't carry, and it's not a very good quality. I don't like this brand. It's too big. It's too clumsy. And then a negative feeling arises because of the contact. And so I may want to upgrade this microphone, so I have at the next committee meeting say to the Buddhist Society, I think you should upgrade these microphones. We want a better one, we need higher quality. And I'll justify my reasons for getting higher quality microphone, and then I'll say that that's going to cost money, and then I'll have to search or get somebody else to search the web for the best microphones of one I particularly like. And we see how it perpetuates, doesn't it? Desire, the feeling of like or dislike will perpetuate the seeking and searching to fulfill the feelings that I want. And then finally I'll find the microphone that I like and I'll say, we have to get that one, and then we buy it, and then I'll get it here. And then if I find out it doesn't work, it produces a fuzzy sound, then this negative feeling arise because I've really put my heart into that, getting the best quality microphone. We see that this contact with the fuzzy sound produces then a negative feeling in the mind. And that's happening constantly in our daily life, isn't it? We're seeing how we're being driven by feelings of like and dislike, wanting and desire. And we're searching to fulfill those pleasurable feelings and to avoid unpleasant feelings. So in the Buddhist practice, we're actually knowing that this is just feeling. So even if, for example, I don't particularly like this microphone, actually I've got a very neutral feeling to this microphone, either like or dislike, but if I don't particularly like this microphone, I can live with that if I have understanding that this is just a feeling of dislike. If I really like this microphone, this is just a feeling of like. Just know it as it is. Then the Buddha goes on to say, what is the foremost of all things? And his response from a Buddhist perspective is, the foremost of all things is concentration. The ability to focus the mind on one thing. Now I need to explain what the Buddha meant by concentration. Now, this is actually a technical term. It means when the mind absorbs in and becomes one with a wholesome object. And this is what we try to do in meditation, is firstly make the mind peaceful. Because only when the mind is peaceful and still and can sustain itself on one object, can then later on we develop wisdom and understanding about that object. So we take up a meditation object of the breath, a neutral or a wholesome object. But you can take up many other objects, for example, the object of loving kindness and emotion, or a color. You can take up many objects to focus the attention on. And if you can sustain your mind for a long period of time on each in-breath and out-breath, then what happens if you're sustaining your mind on one object, then you're not aware of other objects. Okay? I want everyone to look at the fan over there. Just place your attention just on the fan. Now, if you look at the fan for long enough, then your visual perception is limited. The people on the other side of the room have disappeared outside of your visual perception. And by focusing just on one object, you don't know whether the people around you are moving, who's getting up, who's scratching. You don't see what they're doing because your attention is fully focused on that, just that fan. So you see how certain things disappear. When they disappear, when you focus your attention on one object, they come to stillness. You don't know what the other people are doing. It happens too when you focus your mind just on one object, say, for example, the physical breathing, then the distraction of thought, thinking about what your partner's doing, what your children are doing at home tonight, partying when you're at the Buddha Society or whatever, disappears, doesn't it? Because you're focusing your attention just on this in-breathing and out-breathing. You're letting go of all those other distractions of the past, of fear, of anxiety, of worry. You're putting all that down and just staying here with this one object. And as you stay here, then all those things that agitate the mind start to settle down. And the breath becomes very soothing and very peaceful. And then, as the mind becomes very soothing and focusing on the breath, then it stays with the breath. Like the breath is moving in and out, and then the mind just stays with that process of moving in and out. Just like the person sitting under the coconut palm, watching the waves come in, break on the shore, and then go out again. They're just placing their attention on the waves coming in and going out. You're just pacing your attention on the waves of the breath coming in and then going out. And then, as that person places their mind on that one object, it's almost they become one with the waves going in and going out. Their mind becomes one with the breath. It unifies with the breath because there is no observer and observed. There's just the observed, the process of breathing. Now, when this happens, at this point in time, there is great rapture and happiness in the mind because the mind is one-pointed on that breath. And that's the first stage of what the Buddha called samadhi or concentration. The mind is concentrated. Then as that mind becomes deeper and deeper, deeper and deeper in the concentration, the mind becomes unified with the breath totally, and the rapture falls away and there's just pure happiness there. And one-pointedness of mind. Then eventually even happiness subsides because you're calming that mind down, and then there's just pure equanimity and unification of mind. And this is what we call a concentrated mind. It is an experience in meditation, but sometimes even in your daily experience, there may have been certain times in your life when you felt as if the self, the you, has disappeared and you're just one with nature. It's almost like the world has stopped in time and space and there's just stillness. That's a taste of concentration. That's a taste of what the Buddha is saying is the foremost. And that experience can be repeated and developed through the practice of mental cultivation or meditation, cultivating the mind. Then the Buddha says that in response to the question, what is the master of all things? And for a Buddhist, the master of all things is that all things are mastered by mindfulness and awareness. For a Buddhist, the master or the divine essence or the lord of the world is not something external. You can create your own mastery, your own power, through the development of internal awareness, knowing, the ability to recall and remember what you're doing when you're doing it. That is the ability of the mind to know, to recall this present moment and understand the world as it's happening. So that is this powerful knowing. It's the knower, the all-knowing, that knower can become all-knowing. You can always know what's happening in the present moment. That is what we mean by the all-knower. It is not something external to you. The all-knower is the ability to always know, to always be aware of the present moment, what's happening here and now, in this present moment, in this experience, in this situation, what's going on. The power is in your mind. It is not external. It's not dependent on anything else. That ability arises through mindfulness, the ability to fully know, to fully place your mind, your attention, your conscious awareness on what's happening. And have you noticed that actually a lot of the time we are not fully aware of what we're doing, what's happening when we're doing it? That's very much highlighted when we try to sit meditation, isn't it? For all of you, you're very brave. When you sit down and try and watch your mind, you realize how little control there is. The thing that we thought we can control, the thing we thought was ours, when we try to get it to watch the breath for 30 minutes, where does it go to? Sometimes even in 2 minutes, it's gone to a vast array of places and situations. And then we start to see that we're not fully aware of this present moment. We're not fully conscious of the here and now. And so that's this loss of mindfulness is what weakens our mental power. The mental power can be strengthened and created by this ability to know, to remember, to be aware, to place one's conscious attention to the present moment, to the experience of the body and the mind, to the experience of phenomena as they arise and pass away. So this is where we get mastery. So if you want to become master of your life, you do not have to relinquish power, control to anything or anybody else. It is the ability of the mind to know and master itself that we're looking for. What is the peak of all things? What is the highest of all things? The Buddha's response is the highest of all things is wisdom. But what is wisdom? Wisdom in Buddhism is the ability to know the nature of existence and let go. So we know this thing arises, and then we see the whole process. This thing subsides. And when we know that is the nature of things, then we don't desire that thing that we like to stay forever, and the thing that we dislike to not arise. We know that this thing will arise and this thing will pass away. That is the nature of things. That ability to know change and know it with wisdom pulls out the thorn of suffering, because we're not desiring it to be otherwise. We're not desiring to only get promotions and never get the sack, because we know this arises and this passes away. We're not desiring for people to only praise us and never blame us, because we know praise arises and passes away. Blame arises and passes away. We're not desiring just to experience happiness and never experience unhappiness. We know happiness arises and passes away. We're not desiring just to get things and gain material possessions, because we know they come and then someone will take them away. We're not desiring to live eternally, because we know with life we have been born, then it will pass away. And so we see that that's the nature of experience. That is wisdom. Wisdom in Buddhism means not to suffer. If one is suffering, then one is not wise. And the degree of one's wisdom is measurable by the degree that each one of us suffer. If you have no suffering in your experience in your life, you've let go of everything, then that shows one has a highly developed wisdom faculty. That is the quality of the enlightened ones. They do not suffer with age, sickness, and death. They do not suffer with gain or loss, with praise or blame, with happiness and sorrow, with fame or defame. They know this arises and this passes away. The essence, what is the essence of all things? And there's a very interesting... this is an important point, because as you know, when we hear of religious dialogue, often some people say the essence of things is love, something, the essence of everything is energy, the essence of things is nothing. You know, this, we die and that's it. You know, we have many ideas of what's the essence of something. And it was interesting that one time the Buddha met a religious seeker, and during his time there was a vast array of various religious seekers and spiritual people teaching a vast array of traditions. It was really a smorgasbord of religious traditions at that particular time. It was a real a blossoming of religious awareness 2,500 years ago in India. And one man came to see the Buddha, and the Buddha asked him, well, you know, what is your religious tradition? What's the essence of your religious tradition? And his response was that everything sublime is the essence of our religious tradition. And so the Buddha asked him, well, what do you mean by everything sublime is the essence of your religious tradition? And he said, well, even that is sublime. The sublime is the most sublime. There's nothing higher than the sublime. And the Buddha said, well, we could go on for a long time like this, but I wanted you to define, because the Buddha was concerned about what can be known, how do you define something? You can't say that, say, something is nothing or something is, say, just purity, or something is unknowable knowledge. Those words become meaningless when you try to define them. If it's unknowable knowledge, it becomes, as I said earlier, irrelevant, doesn't it? If you can't know it, then it's not knowledgeable, because knowledge has to be knowable. That's what the word says, doesn't it? To know something. If it's unknowable, then it's not knowledgeable. It cannot be known. So sometimes just profound words sound wonderful, but they don't really mean anything in a religious path. The Buddha was very pragmatic. He wanted to know the meaning of things. And so when this religious teacher was saying, it's the sublime, and he worships the essence of the sublime. The Buddha said, he gave an analogy. He said, you're like a man who says, I'm in love with the most beautiful woman in the world. And someone says, well, what does she look like? Well, I don't know, but she's the most beautiful woman in the world. Where does she live? Well, I don't know, but she's the most beautiful woman in the world. What's her family name? Well, I don't know that either, but she's the most beautiful woman in the world. And you see that it becomes a meaningless statement, isn't it? It sounds wonderful to say, I'm in love with the most beautiful woman in the world. But can you define who that person is? Can you describe her? What's her name? What does she look like? How does she appear? And so when we're saying about ultimate truth, if we say, I believe in ultimate truth, that's very profound. But what does those words mean? What do you define by truth? What do you define by ultimate? So we have to be able to give answers. If we're going to know truth, it has to be knowable, it has to be definable, it has to be experienceable. And so the Buddha was not saying that the essence of all things was something outside. It has to be something which can be known. And his response to the essence of all things is, the essence of all things is liberation. Now, one may say, well, that sounds philosophical. But liberation is something you can experience, isn't it? It means the freedom from something. And you can know for yourself whether you're free of something. You can know if you're a prisoner when you're freed from the prison. You can know when you're freed from illness. You can know when you're freed from debt. You can know when you're freed from suffering and you're experiencing happiness. You can know when you're freed from anger and there's loving kindness in the mind. You can know when you're free from selfishness and there's generosity and kindness. You can know when you're freed from greed and exploitation and there's the desire, the compassionate desire to help others and give and share. So liberation in Buddhism means something. It means to know when you're free of what is limiting, what is painful, what is unpleasant, and there is joy. So in meditation you can know when you're free from thinking, can't you? You can experience that and know it in your own mind. At this point, thought has ceased. At this point, the ache in my knee has disappeared. I am free from that. At this point, my worries about my work, my family, my health, etc., etc., I've dropped that. So one is free from that. So freedom and liberation can be known, and that's what the path is about, finding freedom, being liberated from all suffering, or pain or disappointment, and that can be experienced. And the Buddha's reply to the question, where do all things merge? Where do they all converge and merge? And the Buddha's response is, and this will need some explanation, and I'll put it together with the next and the last point, where do all things end? And the Buddha's response is that all things merge in the deathless and in enlightenment, nibbana, is their culmination. That's where things end. And for those people who are familiar with Buddhist tradition, the word deathless is a synonym for enlightenment. And the nibbana actually means enlightenment, but here there's a difference in that here the deathless means the person who becomes fully enlightened but still has life. And then Nibbana is the parinibbana, the final passing away without remainder. And here the Buddha is saying that all things merge in the deathless. That is, that with the culmination of the path and the practice, then it leads to the deathless. In Buddhism, we're talking about deathless because the Buddha was seeking a very pragmatic spiritual path because he saw that he had to experience old age, sickness, and finally death. And he asked himself, is there anything that doesn't die? Anything which escapes from death? Anywhere I can go to get away from this process of death? And so his development of the path was seeking that which does not end, which is an end of ending, something which is an end of ending, the final ending, when things go out. And he realized that if all things are rooted in desire, coming back to the first point, that's where they arise from, that's where they're created from. If desire ceases, then what happens? If desire is the energy for all creation, the desire is the energy for the becoming of your world, then when desire comes to an end and is stilled, then things go to stillness. Things cease, things end. Then there is liberation, then there's freedom. And that is where the deathless is. It doesn't create anymore, because desire, the cause for creation, has disappeared, has come to an end. And desire leads to greed, hatred, and delusion. So greed, hatred, and delusion is the force which drives desire, and desire drives the creation of greed, hatred, and delusion. When we pull out the root of desire, the tree of desire cannot grow, and then it comes to an end, passes away. And so the process of ongoing life in the cycle of samsara, the cycle of existence, the endless rebirth, ceases and stops. It's like the candle, as the Buddha says, that goes out. When all the wax and the wick is burnt up, what happens to the flame? It goes out. When desire is burnt up, what happens? There is the going out, the cooling. Buddha used the word Nibbana, those things that go to stillness and cessation. And so this is the Buddha's response to these 10 philosophical questions and religious questions. Just to summarize and read the sutta over again, it may be, O monks, that wandering ascetics or of other persuasions might ask you, in what are all things rooted? How do they come to actual existence? Where do they arise? Where do they converge? What is the foremost in all things? What is their master? What is the highest of all things? What is the essence of all things? Where do all things merge? Where do they end? If you are thus questioned, monks, you should reply as follows. All things are rooted in desire. They come to actual existence through attention, originate from contact, and converge on feelings. The foremost of all things is concentration. All things are mastered by mindfulness. Their peak is wisdom. Their essence, liberation. All things merge in the deathless, and enlightenment, Nibbana, is their culmination.